This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Recording studio owner Eric Nelson says he's been worried for years that cheap home recording technology would kill his business.
Actually, I'm busier than I ever was, and I'm charging more than I was, so yeah, it's I'm doing well.
John Norton reports on the thriving Twin Cities recording industry. Plus, everyone knows zoning is important, but GLT's Ryan Denham achieves the impossible in his report on the zoning overhaul in Bloomington. He makes it interesting. And teachers' unions in the Twin Cities assess the impact of the Janus decision by the U.S. Supreme Court, forcing unions to stop charging dues to teachers who are not members of the unions. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This summer, the Supreme Court dealt a major blow to public sector unions, the Janus decision. The court ruled these unions cannot collect money, known as agency fees, from non-members who are covered by collective bargaining agreements. Some labor experts predict teachers' unions will lose members as a result and weaken them as a political force. Unit 5 Teachers Union President Lindsay Dickinson tells GLT's Ryan Denham she hasn't seen many dues-paying members leave the union yet. And next door in District 87, Union President Joe Lewis says they never collected agency fees anyway, making them a test case for the post-Janus future.
In our association, we have never charged an agency fee. So even though, like all districts, our contract represents all members, and therefore union presidents like myself have to represent all members under the contract, even the members who don't join the union, they don't pay any fees at all. And I'm still bound to represent them because they fall under our contract. Now, that being said, we've had over our history right around 80% membership who have always voluntarily joined, and only around, you know, usually it's the beginning teachers and the teachers, to a lesser extent, the teachers at the end of their career choose not to join for various reasons. But generally speaking, we've had very good membership numbers without that agency fee. So as far as Janus goes, we're kind of a test case, I think, for what might happen in Illinois, which is, I don't know what 80, I mean, the numbers are higher at Unit 5 right now, but 80% membership does seem to sustain us at Bloomington Education Association pretty well.
And so, Lindsay, with Unit 5 Education Association, what is the split between teachers who are full union dues paying members and then those who in the past have been covered with agency fees that they've paid?
Sure. So we have about 1,000 teachers and certified staff in Unit 5. Prior to Janus, we had three members that were fee payers. They were fair share members. So they received all the same benefits of the contract, but if something were to go wrong, they wouldn't have union representation unless it fell under the contract. Now we have about 7 or 8 members from new hires or people that have dropped. So we have about 7 or 8 that are not members right now. We call them potential members. So right now we have about 7 or 8 out of 1,000. I mean, hopefully we fall under the same success rate as Bloomington did with about 80%, but right now we're looking pretty good.
What kind of feedback and questions did you hear from your members in the weeks and months after the Janus decision at the Supreme Court?
So for us, it was a lot of people asking questions of what does this mean? What is the difference? And now we have to educate members on what the difference is and what things you receive by being a member of the union or a potential member. So I think on my behalf, it's been a lot of education of members, a lot of things of this is what it means for us. Yes, you still have a contract. Yes, you're still on the salary schedule. Yes, everything is pretty much the same. Just now some of the added benefits of being a union member is different.
Although the decision did not affect or impact our members, which I told them that, there was a big change coming that we tried to educate our members about starting last spring. And namely, that's the Freedom of Information Act requests, which have been sought by people who want to mail out to our members information about Janus, telling them, hey, now you can drop. And even though our members weren't paying an agency fee, that was something that me and my staff spent a lot of time trying to educate our members about whether or not these mailings apply to them, which, you know, of course they did. They could drop their membership, but we had to ensure them, make sure they understood that there were really no changes for them, and if they wanted to remain members, they could do so.
Have you seen a lot of outreach from, you know, these sort of opt-out groups that are trying to connect with teacher union members?
Absolutely. The day after Janice came down in June, I even received an email. There's two predominant groups, the Illinois Policy Institute and the Mackinac Center. Those two groups are primarily funded by Bruce Renner, our governor, and they are sending mailers out that a lot of it, while yes, you can drop your membership, but a lot of the information that they're including is completely false. Dues money cannot go to political reasons, they cannot go to politicians. So they're using all the money that does go to those politicians, people have to elect to give them that money. So they're using that and changing it into a falsity to give people a leg up to being able to drop memberships. I mean, I've received them. I know that a couple people in Bloomington this last week have received them. We expect that to start relatively soon.
Right. I just learned today that there's a mailer going out. And it has much of the same misinformation that Lindsay just talked about, namely that their dues money goes to pay for political races. And we have a completely separate account. It's called iPACE, that is optional for members, completely voluntary, and that's where the political contributions go. Dues money, far and away, goes to pay for maintaining the contract and using IEA's resources to make sure that all the districts have proper negotiations, the grievances are filed correctly. And I think members need to understand that the political money is completely separate from the money that maintains our organization's contractual rights.
You know, Joe, at the beginning you were talking about how the Bloomington Education Association has sustained all these years without agency fees and just relying on the dues that are coming in from union members, and then those who are not members mm-hmm. just simply don't pay but are still represented. So since the Janice decision, have you been contacted by those in the education labor world to ask, like, okay, so how has it worked here? If you guys have been in the middle of the state of Illinois, but you've kind of had this model, how did it work? How were you able to sustain yourselves for so long?
Right. That's been going on for over a year now. IEA has asked us, because I believe if we're not the largest district that did not charge fees, we're close. And really, our message is simple. If members understand the difference, like I said before, between political contributions and IPACE, and the fact that we have a lot of contractual issues, especially bargaining, and making sure the contract is fulfilled by all parties. Once members understand that, they see the value of the contract, because in essence, the contract allows them to make professional decisions that we as educators want to bring to the table, because we want what's best for kids. And since we're the ones in the classroom, they say, wow, this contract really lets me have a say in what's happening in that classroom. Once they realize that, then a membership really takes care of itself.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm here in studio with Lindsay Dickinson, the Unit 5 Education Association President, and Joe Lewis, President of the Bloomington Education Association. Their unions represent teachers in Unit 5 and District 87, respectively. So Lindsay and Joe, in Wisconsin and Michigan, unions had already lost the power to collect agency fees. Their NEA teacher union chapters had lost membership as a result of that. One union official said there that we had to let people know that your union does so much more than just bargain a contract. Do you think that'll happen in Illinois too, that need to better explain what the union does for its members?
I absolutely think so. One of the things that I have been predominantly focusing on so far this year is all the professional development opportunities that we are provided because we are a unionized district. So things like ACEs training, adverse childhood experiences, we're doing a very large push throughout the country, but a lot in our own district, about the trauma that children go through at home, and then what we as teachers and as educators can do to help them be successful in their lives at school. Things of mindfulness and meditation and you know, strategies that they can pull out of their toolbox when a difficult situation arises with them. So we have to make sure now that people understand the other benefits besides just contract negotiations that we're able to provide. Now, if I look at Wisconsin, Michigan, Indiana, one of the big things that has always been told is that when they lost their power to collectively bargain, and when they lost all of these union rights, that people had all these other rules applied to them. Women had dress codes. They had to go to school in dresses or skirts and high heels, and all of these really bad case scenarios. So we have to continue here in Illinois to make sure that people see the benefits of being in a union and the benefits of being unionized to make sure that we maintain our membership.
Illinois Education Association, with all of our members, they provide a lot of training. And earlier I mentioned that the union, in my view, allows us to make a lot of professional decisions. Well, IEA gives us training to help us articulate those things that we do in the classroom that we bring to kids. And like I said, we're the ones in the classroom every single day. And with IEA's resources, we're able to translate that into better outcomes for the kids, which then allows us to go out and say, hey, everyone wants what's best for kids, everyone at the table. But we were able to take what we've learned and explain to them how all these things that our union has allowed us to learn are helping our students in the classroom.
So in communities and states with agency fees in public sector collective bargaining, I guess what's the flip side of that? Is there any proven relationship in those types of states to higher teacher salaries, higher school funding? And what are some of those connections that Illinois may lose as a result of this?
So when right-to-work states started really becoming prominent and throughout the media a couple of years back, there is a correlation between having unions and having union rights and higher wages. So if you look at like the top states that have collective bargaining, it is proven that teachers' salaries are higher in those states than in other states. The thing that always is hard to deal with is that in impoverished communities, you have to make sure that you are one collective voice to be able to fend for and fight for what is right. Because like Joe said, whatever the teachers' working conditions are, that's our students' learning conditions. And we have to make sure that not only are our teachers successful, but our ultimate goal is to make sure that our students are successful. So one of the biggest pieces of that is having a salary that people can live off of. So collective bargaining is a joint correlation to having a higher starting salary and having a higher wage.
I wonder whether or not we'll see more strikes as a result of this decision. If every state in the country is going to be playing by these types of rules now, are we going to see more dramatic actions by teachers who don't have a satisfactory experience at the bargaining table?
I think that's a fascinating question. I tried to follow as much as I could the West Virginia strikes, yeah, and the was it Colorado,
Arizona,
Kentucky, Arizona, and it seems, I mean, some of those states seem to have unions that were somewhat robust, some didn't, but in the end, I think it just depends. I mean, the union is the teachers. I mean, a lot of people, I think, misconstrue the union as a top-down organization. It's really not. So I think in those states, maybe I don't want to speculate too much, but in our case, our teachers see the value of the union and are able to speak through it, and therefore we haven't even talked about a strike in years, and that's speaking District 87 without fair share. So all I can guess from what I've read in those states, those teachers felt like they lost their voice. And yeah, teachers are probably going to become more militant because they'll see negative impacts on the students in their classroom. And if that happened here, I would imagine we would become angrier as well. But right now, our voice is heard, and that's important.
And I guess if we look at West Virginia, they had to negotiate their pay through state legislature. It was done by the state. It was not individual districts. And I think that maybe that has something to do with it. I mean, we know that if you are trying to negotiate a salary for hundreds of thousands of teachers, that's going to be hard to do versus our local contract negotiations probably would be able to go much faster with having to not so much talk about strikes or problems. Being able to do it at a lower level would probably, I would think, would be a lot easier to be able to handle than doing it statewide.
When the unions are from the grassroots, that's where the power is, then teachers are able to negotiate at that lower level, and therefore there's no need for militancy. They have their voice.
That's Joe Lewis, president of the Bloomington Education Association, and Lindsay Dickinson, president of the Unit 5 Education Association. They represent teachers working in Unit 5 and District 87. I'm Ryan Denham.
Hear more about the challenges faced by Illinois teachers in GLT's Skipping School series for a different perspective on the state's teacher shortage crisis. Find the whole series at wglt.org/skippingschool.
Support for GLT comes from the Rhonda Glenn Law Offices. With offices in McLean and Livingston counties, they've served clients throughout Illinois for 30 years with quality legal services and family law, including adoption and dissolution of marriage. Information at glennlawoffices.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, Ryan Denham reports on a zoning overhaul in Bloomington. The seismic event in Illinois politics of the month is the decision by Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel to not run for a third term. But even the Illinois Politics Roundtable is not sure why he did that. Brian Mackey goes over the signs, along with Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield, Amanda Vinicky of Chicago Public Television, and A.D. Quigg, who reports for the Daily Line.
You know, the chatter is the polling wasn't that great. We also had the start of the Laquan McDonald trial of Jason Van Dyke beginning this week, which was just going to bring more and more attention on, you know, this police shooting and alleged cover-up of the video of the shooting where this young black teenager was being shot 16 times and kind of drawing attention to the problems in the police department. He kind of poo-pooed that a little bit, but he has not really expressed why he's leaving, but he has said he does not think that his successor is in the current field that we have now of 12 candidates, which is really interesting.
I will add that he got very choked up when making the announcement and has in subsequent interviews as well, particularly when speaking about his family. And his wife, Amy Rule, was standing by the mayor's side when he made the announcement about not running for re-election. And at one point, she grabbed his hand and really, they wrapped arms at the podium. Some videos you can see it, in others you can't. It was, in a sense, a subtle gesture, and yet, at the same time, a very powerful one. And he said people always want to say it's more time with family, but the mayor did talk about how he had just returned from, for example, the funeral for Senator John McCain. I talked to somebody who said they couldn't imagine Amy Rule looking happier than if she'd won the lottery. I mean, the mayor had gone through people protesting outside his home. It has certainly been a rough 8 years. So it may be that, yeah, he didn't want to lose. He's never lost an election before and didn't want to go out on a sour note. It could be, you know, some speculation that you hear out there. This could be a launch. Obviously, he has had a role in national politics previously, and while we are focused on the gubernatorial and mayoral elections, certainly looking ahead to 2020, could this be, you know, step out now and then launch pad going forward for something having to do with the next presidential cycle? I mean, we really, really don't know, and he hasn't given an answer, but I think everybody's gut kind of says different things, and those are all things to keep in mind.
AD mentioned the Laquan McDonald video, and of course the trial of Jason Van Dyke getting underway. I mean, that's something that was, I mean, I guess he still claims that he didn't see it, but it was viewed as problematic enough that that was kind of kept from the public until after the last election. And there were protests that have erupted. It was one of the big contributing factors to the national Black Lives Matter movement. I don't want to just gloss over that too much. Are people talking about that as being a potential big factor here?
Certainly, you have a lot of activists part of that Black Lives Matter or related organizations, CTU as well, so not related to Laquan McDonald, but I think you have a lot of activists that are taking credit for this. I mean, not only celebrating that he is not going to be running for a third term, but again, really taking credit for it and saying that we chased him out of there. It was our activism that did that. This trial, we don't know how long it will go on. There was a protest on that first day. The folks that I talked to said, you know, we're not talking about violence per se, but if Van Dyke is acquitted, it will be a slap in the face, particularly to Chicago residents of color, and they vowed to try and rally and bring down the city like Chicago has never seen. That is a great big unknown, not just for Rahm Emanuel's political future, but in general for the future of this city at this point in time.
Yes, and the thing that I keep returning to is that I don't see a good outcome for Rahm Emanuel either way that this trial comes out. If Jason Van Dyke is acquitted, you're going to have a lot of activists upset. There's a lot of worry about rioting. But also, if Jason Van Dyke is acquitted,
if he's convicted, yeah.
Yeah, I think the damage done between Rahm Emanuel and police officers, the loss of popularity he's had among police officers isn't going to be fixed either.
That's certainly something else that people have talked about as being a factor. As we've seen the crime rate come up, and after that video, he was talking about officers, quote, going fetal, I think. Charlie, I want to ask you, is this the way Chicago mayors typically go out, under a hail of criticism?
I think his record will be looked at as being kind of a mixed bag. If you look at the area of economic development, of building up the loop, the downtown area, the near west side, bringing in national companies, high-tech companies, Rahm did very well. And he's cemented Chicago's position as a world-class city. If you look out in the neighborhoods, not so well, particularly on the west side and the south side, where there are large numbers of folks of color living. The closing of the schools in the neighborhoods, that upset a lot of people. You could argue, well, there's not enough kids going, so we're going to shut down the school. But if you're living there and this is your neighborhood school and it's being closed, that's going to upset people. The fact that he decided to confront the pension system, the underfunding, and push through the city council a number of property tax increases to deal with that, that didn't make people happy. Plus, there's another big bump coming up in their next budget where they have to dedicate something like $200 million more towards the pension liability. So he's done some good things, but on the other hand, he has not been able to solve the problem of how do we bring the economic development into the low-income neighborhoods? How do we provide opportunities for youth, particularly youth of color, that would give them some hope in their life? I think it will be, as they say, it'll be a mixed review on Emmanuel.
Yeah, and I noticed particularly this week the Chicago Tribune columnist Eric Zorn, who also said he saw a mixed bag from the tenure, and he said that he thought that Emmanuel inherited a steaming mess from Mayor Richard M. Daley, who, quote, whose toes are probably still sore from vigorously kicking so many cans down the road.
IPR's Brian Mackey moderated the Illinois Politics Roundtable, composed of Charlie Wheeler, the head of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois at Springfield, Amanda Vinicky of Chicago Public Television, and A.D. Quigg, who reports for the Daily Line. This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media.
Support for GLT comes from TEDx Normal, an independently organized local TED event enriching the Bloomington Normal community with ideas worth sharing. Held at the Center for Performing Arts on ISU's campus, Saturday, October 27th, 9 to noon. Tickets available at TEDxNormal.net. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, John Norton takes a deep dive into the recording industry in central Illinois. You might not realize it, but there's an invisible layer hiding right under the surface here in Bloomington Normal, and it plays a huge role in who gets to do what and where they get to do it. It's the zoning code, and Bloomington is due for a much-needed overhaul of that document. It's been years since the city's land use rules got a makeover. GLT's Ryan Denham explores what's at stake, from where you park your car to what your neighbor can put in his yard.
That's the sound of Jeff Henry's bees. Jeff is an urban beekeeper here in Bloomington, hoping to reverse an alarming decline in pollinators like honeybees that threatens our global food supply. But first, Henry has a smaller problem to deal with, city zoning code. Henry has three hives against his back fence at his Founders Grove home, producing enough honey to make bread and keep his neighbors happy. So the father of three was concerned with the first draft of a new beekeeping ordinance that would have required his hives to be 20 feet away from his lot line. He'd have to move his hives into the middle of his driveway. For someone with a smaller lot, that might be inside their kitchen.
There's all kinds of signs in different grocery stores about tomatoes and cucumbers and green peppers and pumpkins, and all these things are pollinated by bees. So if you don't have bees, you can really look around your grocery store and see a lot of foods that are going to go away. And they haven't come up with a good alternative to bees pollinating the crops.
So if it's not 20 feet, what should it be?
I believe the Peoria and the Springfield have a 4 feet or 6 feet off of a lot line. Again, bees fly in a 2 mile radius. You know, we're standing here however many 10 feet away from the hives and we haven't seen a bee. So it's not that big of a deal. So I don't know what the magic number is, but I just think 20 is a big number.
The beekeeper changes are one small part of a major multi-year zoning overhaul underway in Bloomington. Sparked by the city's 2015 comprehensive plan, the Bloomington Planning Commission and a consultant have been rewriting the entire code, hoping to craft an easier-to-understand guide for what you can do where. Here's Bloomington city planner Katie Simpson.
The current zoning ordinance really needed to be modernized. It allows for uses such as like a telegraph message center, which we probably don't see too many of anymore.
Like other parts of the zoning overhaul, the proposed changes related to beekeeping connect to a goal within the city's comprehensive plan, in this case, to encourage local food production. That's people like Henry, who learned the craft by taking a class with the Central Illinois Beekeepers Association. He makes honey under the name Henry's Honeys, a nod to his three daughters.
We initially went around to the neighbors, even prior to getting the hives. We asked a bunch of the neighbors what their thoughts were, and everyone was all for it. Everyone around here understands the implications on the environment that bees bring. So we made a conscious effort to try to contact as many neighbors as we could. And everyone was completely in favor of it.
Henry voiced his concerns about the zoning changes earlier this year. He met one-on-one with Bloomington Planning Commission Chairman Justin Boyd. And it worked. The latest version of the beekeeping ordinance lowered the minimum lot line distance to 10 feet, down from the 20 originally proposed by the city's consultant, Chicago-based Housel Levine Associates. Here's Justin Boyd.
But in all fairness, John Housel and his associate or his group, they're not beekeepers either. So they're looking at some of these ordinances throughout the country and trying to put together something. And again, that's why it's important that the beekeepers got involved so we could understand their point of view.
Boyd says zoning code needs to be written for everyone. That's the beekeepers and those who may have concerns about, bees.
They have changed the way this proposal is written just by them showing up, speaking at meetings, and emailing and talking one-on-one with us.
The zoning overhaul covers a lot more than just bees. Some of the current code dates back to its inception in the 1960s, although Simpson says there have been some minor changes in cleanup in 1979 and again in 2006. This overhaul started in 2016 when the consultant was hired for $125,000 and the Planning Commission began working on it. They've made revisions section by section, and they're just about done with all 17 chapters. The final drafts are on the city's website. One of the top priorities was reducing minimum lot sizes. Right now, they're too big, meaning nearly 3,000 residential lots are technically non-conforming. Simpson says that could make it harder for a homeowner to get a loan. Another priority was carving up the massive 26-block downtown district into three distinct zones, each with its own purpose. Pedestrian access and circulation would be prioritized in that downtown core district and a second transitional buffer district. Simpson says the third area would be a new warehouse district south of downtown geared toward arts and entertainment, maybe even breweries.
That type of district would allow for live-work art spaces, urban agriculture, hydroponics, aquaponics, restaurants, retail, commercial community kitchens, things of that nature that are kind of industrial but tailor more towards the entrepreneurial sector, and that's a district that we don't currently have.
The zoning overhaul also deals with various transportation goals in the city's comprehensive plan. It would encourage shared parking between businesses and electric vehicle charging stations, while adding incentives for carpooling or car sharing spaces. Justin Boyd says it would also promote bicycle parking. A business could offer up to 10% fewer car spots if it offers corresponding amounts of bike spots.
All these kind of new things that have just kind of developed over the last couple years, we need to be planning for those.
One thing it won't do is eliminate parking minimums, or the minimum number of spots a business must have in its parking lot. That concept is growing in popularity as cities try to make themselves more walkable and greener. That's according to Daniel Harrigus with Strong Towns, a national media and advocacy group that aims for financially strong and resilient municipalities.
The number of cities moving away from it is growing. But Strong Towns, we'd certainly like to see it grow a lot faster. If that parking minimum can be a huge hindrance for small businesses, and it can be a huge impediment to the walkability of an area if you're devoting like half the land to parking spaces that are sitting empty a lot of the time.
Instead, Bloomington is adding parking maximum, essentially capping the number of oft unused spots a developer can add, say outside a big box store. The city's current B3 downtown district is the only one without parking minimums today. Here's Justin Boyd.
All of us have driven by some parking lots in the past and thought, why is this so large? and what kind of development could we start seeing if we didn't require that much parking? Here locally, I mean, I think of like Lowe's, the Dick's parking lot, the former Kmart. Not that those stores aren't successful, but they would have to be slammed every bit of every day to fill up those parking lots. So we could probably get some more tax revenue if we were able to develop in some of those spots.
Simpson says the city is exploring parking maximums of 25%, meaning if the city's zoning code required your business to have, say, 100 spots, you could only have up to 125. She says that will allow for more greenery and landscaping, and reducing the amount of concrete surface area can improve stormwater quality.
Parking is necessary. It's a necessary evil, right? We need it, but it doesn't always get used.
If you're curious about what's in the new zoning overhaul, city officials say now is the time to speak up. The final drafts are available on the Bloomington City website. The consultant, Household Levine Associates, will present the changes to the Bloomington City Council sometime this fall, followed by a community Q&A session and a public hearing. It's expected to come up for a final city council vote by the end of the year. Here's Justin Boyd.
Vast majority of these types of things happen on these boards and commissions throughout the city, and it'd be wise for the public to show up and have their voices heard early in the process before it gets to council.
Daniel Harrigus with Strong Towns says getting the public involved early on is key.
Because we've seen some overhaul efforts really go awry when that grassroots level conversation hasn't happened properly.
Simpson stresses that 6,000 community members were involved in the development of the comprehensive plan that underpins the zoning overhaul. That's good because Harrigus says top-down overhauls can be problematic. The city of Austin, Texas recently scrapped a major and controversial overhaul of its land use code because of a combination of significant disruptions to the process. It cost 5 years and $8.5 million. Harrigus says planning and design professionals can sometimes operate in a bubble, and community input opens that up.
I spend a lot of time talking with people who are in the planning and architecture and development worlds, and there's a certain amount of a bubble that exists where we think, oh, you know, urban density, walkability, mixed use, we take for granted that these things are desirable. And sometimes when our buzzwords make it out to the public, the reaction is very different.
If approved, Community Development Director Bob Mart says part two of the process would then begin, actually rezoning around 450 properties based on the new zoning code. I'm Ryan Denham.
You can find a link to the proposed zoning overhaul at our website, WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Music industry experts have predicted the demise of the traditional recording studio for nearly two decades. The price of recording software and technology has fallen steeply. The process of recording music is democratized. Anyone with expertise or ambition uses programs such as Pro Tools and Logic to record at home. But independent professional recording studios are actually thriving, even in Bloomington Normal. GLT's John Norton reports.
Tommy O'Donnell is one of two guitarists in the now reformed Something Brothers band that rocked Central Illinois in the 80s and 90s. He's also in the popular jazz rock quartet Ink Trail. O'Donnell and many other Twin City musicians tell GLT home recording studios are everywhere. On this Sunday afternoon, he's recording song ideas in his basement studio.
Oh, wow. This sounds like it might be Ink Trail stuff.
Yeah, no, this is more Ink Trail stuff, so I would demo weird stuff like this and give it to John and Mike. And then
O'Donnell says home setups in the Twin Cities range from near professional grade to more primitive setups like his.
If it's making you be creative and you're feeling good about making music in whatever capacity at your home studio, that's what it's all about.
O'Donnell's setup includes a microphone directed at a guitar amp in the downstairs bathroom, which is just around the corner of the room he uses as the control room. In the studio, among other toys, is a preamp, a four-channel analog to digital converter, and an Apple computer.
Most musicians in Bloomington who either have been in bands or are in bands or just want to play all the time, especially people who are writing their own tunes, the logical move is to have something in another room or the basement of their house where they can record.
This is a song from the 2017 EP No Retreat by the Normal-based folk rock sextet Sherwood Forest. Most listeners probably can't tell the 20-somethings recorded the album in the basement of the home shared by band members Mitchell Owens and Matt Powers. Owens says recording at home gave the band
more freedom with like what we can do. It just kind of gave us more sense of control, and it was also free.
Owens understands home recordings won't have the pop professional engineers bring to music, but when the choice is spending thousands of dollars you don't have to record in a professional studio or recording at home for free, well, Owens says there is no choice.
We were kind of stuck in a rut of not really making much money from shows at the time, so it would have taken us either a really long time to raise the money to record it properly, or we just would have had to put it on hold.
These home studio experiences is exactly what worried Eric Nelson at Eclipse Studios in Normal at the dawn of the home recording revolution.
You know, especially in the early 2000s, thinking, well, you know, how long is this going to work? You know, I'm busy now, but, you know, you know, it's getting cheaper and cheaper all the time. You can buy all this stuff for your computer.
As it turns out, Nelson's worries were for nothing.
Actually, I'm busier than I ever was. And I'm charging more than I was, so yeah, I'm doing well.
One reason Nelson feels his business is booming is because of home recordings. As more and more artists record at home, many produce what he characterizes as decent quality home recordings. In turn, this has raised the quality bar for both home and professional studios. Nelson says artists, though, want to sound better than a decent home recording.
A lot of these people find it's just not that easy. You can get recording pretty quickly, but to get really good results is very difficult, and a lot of people end up calling me at some point because they need a professional to do it for them.
Defining the difference between a professional recording studio and a home recording studio can be tricky. Legendary producer Rick Rubin's Shangri-La studio, attached to his Malibu home in Southern California, certainly also meets the definition of a professional studio. Artist Fernando Gross maintains a home studio is simply a place in your home to record. A commercial recording studio handles a variety of projects and workflows and allows for many sonic signatures. An independent professional recording studio, also known as a project studio, is one that can be in the home but is more likely not. It's designed for a single artist, band, or producer at a time. There are 4 project studios in Bloomington Normal. 2 are part-time. The other 2, including Eric Nelson's Eclipse Studios, are full-time.
Yeah, that's on me. Sorry.
You guys could actually, you guys could just jump in and start right from there.
Nelson is engineering a session with Central Illinois Red Dirt Americana band Blacktop Audio.
Yeah, I'll just splice it together.
Yeah, just start on that first stop and we'll just.
His studio is in a small, inconspicuous building near the Constitution Trail. A few guitars hang on a wall, so do 3 gold and platinum records. One of his 3 Grammy nominations hangs on another wall. Nelson says smaller independent studios like his are now the professional norm, and that large legacy commercial studios, such as the Hit Factory in New York City and other iconic ones, shuttered with the advance of recording technology.
And it's really sad, but you don't really need those giant mixing boards that fill up an entire room and cost you $1,000 a month in electricity. And most of the big hit records are being done in small production studios similar to this.
Nelson's first professional studio was called Sine Waves. He ran it in the mid to late 90s out of a 130-year-old building that still stands on West Market Street in Bloomington. That's when he used one of those large mixing boards to engineer, mix, and master the debut EP for Peoria band Mudvayne. That metal group went on to major label success.
Eventually, my partner and I went our separate ways, and he moved up to Chicago, and I stayed down here and kept all my clients and kind of moved over. Found this place.
Nelson went on to open Eclipse Studios in 2000. Shiny on Top, owned by Edwin Pierce, was a transition for him.
But also Tony Sanfilippo was like the head engineer there.
Mr. John.
Hey, Tony. What are you doing right now?
I'm making sure the drum mics are all showing up where they're supposed to on the mixing desk for a project with Jeff Walker tonight.
It's a sunny late August afternoon, and Tony Sanfilippo is now the owner, operator, producer, chief engineer,
and head janitor at Oxide Lounge Recording in Bloomington, Illinois.
It's the other full-time independent recording studio in the Twin Cities. The 1940s building once housed Bloomington Gas Company. A drum set sits on a large rug that covers a wood floor. A homemade 4x8 wood frame cushion hangs 10 feet above above the tall room, Sanfilippo calls it a cloud that helps focus bright sounds like cymbals without deadening the room.
The great thing about it is the 14-foot vaulted ceilings, so there's still a lot of massive air, so you can create a lot of sound and not have it choke itself. And because of the sheer volume of the room, you can get pretty loud in here, and it doesn't fold, and it doesn't kind of get all boxy sounding.
Widow 4x4 on 4-bed liberator.
From the first time really hearing John, I kind of heard his voice being recorded in that room at Oxide Lounge.
That's Bloomington musician Edward David Anderson. He produced John Till's most recent album, Work Away the Day, at Oxide Lounge.
It's not a huge room, but it's got big tall ceilings. You can hear the depth, you can hear the sound of the room. I wanted it to be kind of an old school, kind of going with this old country blues kind of thing, an old school sound. And I really feel like we achieved that.
That's one reason Sanfilippo believes professional recording studios will remain viable. He says unique spaces like his still matter. He says decades of experience engineering and producing hundreds of bands of all genres gives him a perspective most home studio recorders are still years from learning. But technology has altered his business model in a couple of ways. One is that full album sessions like John Till's are on the decline. Sanfilippo recalls Oxide Lounge's early years as a time when he always engineered a project that was at least six songs. Now, streaming services, including iTunes, Spotify, and Pandora, encourage music consumption in smaller bites. That has him recording one or two songs in 60% of his sessions.
And a single isn't even what a single was when you and I were young, where it was an A-side and a B-side, because it's being released on the internet. It's one song. It is a true single.
That means musicians need less studio time, and Sanfilippo makes less money. Eric Nelson has seen that same trend at Eclipse. He says even major label artists are releasing singles seemingly at random. Professional recording studios also now frequently blend their services with home recording studios. Sanfilippo says it's common for him to record drum, bass, and guitar parts by the artist in his studio, then mix the entire project at Oxide Lounge with the artist's home-recorded vocals and solo parts.
So I'm working in tandem with the home studio, not in opposition of the home studio is bad. No, home studios are great. People save a lot of money that way.
That's how Brandon Beck approaches his recordings.
In a world full of angels and demons, good and evil.
I wouldn't be the artist I am today if it wasn't for the home studio that my father put in the house when I was 10.
Beck is an Atlanta, Georgia hip-hop artist with roots in Bloomington. He's a prolific songwriter who performs and records under the name Brandon Daz. Beck says he first makes beats with a producer or musician in an outside studio, then lays down vocals in his home studio before bouncing the work back to a producer and engineer in another studio for the final mix.
Probably to another home studio even, because even with the big studios, it might be where Lil Wayne recorded it, but who engineered it could be entirely from his camp. That was just the space he was using.
Beck says by recording parts in his own studio and hiring someone else to mix the songs, he can create a lot of music.
Without the hassle of having to make as much money back.
Now, which of these three do you think was a friend to the man?
Bombsite Recording Studio is the third and newest independent professional studio in the Twin Cities. Owner David Rossi opened his West Bloomington shop in 2015.
I think everybody can record at home.
He, too, occasionally blends home recordings into sessions and embraces home recorders.
But at some point in time, you're going to start hearing and understanding the deficiencies in your home recording process, and you're going to understand that you need somebody with more experience and, unfortunately, better gear to some extent to get the sounds that you need to make a record that you actually want to put out.
Rossi played drums for the suburban Chicago punk band Alistair for a few years. That's when the recording bug hit him. He started with a home-based project studio before opening his own outside studio in Des Moines during college. Unlike Sanfilippo at Oxide Lounge and Eric Nelson at Eclipse Studios, Bombsite isn't a full-time gig for Rossi. His day job? McLean County Assistant State's Attorney.
I always struggle tracking the proper balance, and I think my wife could probably attest to that as well. But
Rossi says he came to understand he needs both music and law in his life. The two disciplines, he says, exercise different parts of his brain. As a part-time engineer-producer, he says he can and is picky about whom he decides to record.
If you're recording in my studio, we probably know each other, we probably like each other a lot, and I probably also really like your band.
Oh man, David's great. He's like family.
That's Austin Smith with the Peoria-based rock band Cole Hollow. This song is from their soon-to-be-released debut album. Via Skype, Smith says he's been producing EDM, hip-hop, rock and roll, and metal music for other artists in his basement home studio for 7 years. Yet when it was time for Cole Hollow to record its debut album, members opted to work elsewhere to get an outside voice.
The most important part of our record was that we could bounce those ideas off of David, and he just has a really great mind and an ear. We don't mind working with David and paying for a great quality product that we know is going to last.
Yeah, and I'm a little concerned when we do that punch-in.
We're back in the Eclipse Studios as Blacktop Audio is putting the recording finishes on their new album. Band member Jack Shelmadine says the group knows their live sound is tight from decades of playing together.
We probably should just run the whole tune one more time.
But the studio, that's a different animal.
We've tried to capture our own sound many, many times. Digital recorders, there's a lot of machinery out there that can help you capture the music, but it's not really making the music. It's not really bringing the music to life. That's what a good producer, that's what a good studio does.
Across town, Tony Sanfilippo says he brings those same intangibles to his studio.
Whenever anybody's in my studio, to me, I'm joining the band at that time.
Singer-songwriter Sarah Kwa recorded her 2017 full-length album, Taking Me Back, at Sanfilippo's Oxide Lounge. That's where Sanfilippo also acted as a full producer.
I don't think that the album would be what it is if it was just my vision.
Like driving with the windows open.
It was my writing, but really, that's where the solo part ended, and it became this collaboration between the two of us. Because Tony has an amazing imagination.
The fourth independent professional recording studio in the Twin Cities is also a part-time endeavor, and it's the only one in a home.
I'm Micah Hathaway from Bloomington, Illinois, and I'm the owner here at EMG Audio Labs. I'm also the producer and audio engineer here.
Hathaway has been working in his basement studio for roughly 8 years. He said he really began to ramp up EMG Labs after a workshop a few years ago with legendary producer Alan Parsons. This was at a prominent Chicago recording studio.
Hearing behind-the-scenes stories and ways to get great sounds from somebody that you knew had been assistant engineer on the last two Beatles albums. You know, like, this guy knew his history.
I mean, I think it sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, once
on a weekend afternoon, Hathaway is plotting song approaches with Joey Shull and Ike Lindsay of the Bloomington metal band Event of Collapse. It's one of several sessions the ISU grad and longtime computer programmer is working on this summer between day jobs, with State Farm his most recent gig. But as you catch an initial glimpse halfway down the stairs to the basement housing his gorgeous and plush studio, it's obvious EMG Labs is no second job.
We've talked about a couple of bands and I've been in, and I still, you know, play live music, but I'm significantly more passionate about recording and helping bands make their recordings.
The trend he's seeing is the desire from bands for a retro sound. Despite advanced software and plugins that offer access to sounds unimaginable even a few years ago, Hathaway says modern isn't the sound bands clamor for.
They want to sound like mid to late 80s Metallica. They want to sound like 70s classic rock. They want to sound like 50s, 60s bluegrass band. You know, we're in central Illinois, and I just think that this is where this kind of music lives.
So what lies ahead? One legendary commercial recording studio has already adapted to home and smaller studios with an online component. Abbey Road Studios in London is where the Beatles cut their albums with producer George Martin. Today, for a per-song fee, individual songs can be uploaded to the Abbey Road website to be mastered by Abbey Road engineers. You can even upload individual instrumental and vocal tracks where those same engineers will mix them. David Rossi at Bombsite has been keeping his eye on Lander. That's an online cloud-based automated mastering service. Mastering is the icing on the cake. It's the final step that hopefully makes the final mix of any song pop. Rossi says with Lander, you just upload final song mixes to their website, then an algorithm automatically masters the track.
And that is a perfect example of a company trying to disrupt the industry.
Rossi also speculated on new technology that would hit a little closer to home and his pocketbook. Websites designed for uploading individual bass, drum, guitar, and vocal tracks.
And based off of machine and computer learning, a computer program would attempt to then mix an entire record for you based off of individually uploaded tracks. I can 100% foresee that in the future.
This demo I've had for a while, but I would, if I was to add a lead to it, I can go, just grab a track.
We're back in Bloomington musician Tommy O'Donnell's basement home studio.
I think the fact that you don't see the bigger studios around here closing gives you a clue that if it was going to happen where they, you know, the home recording thing just took over, if that was going to happen, it would have already happened.
When automated computer mixing begins to happen more, it will be interesting to see how today's independent studios adapt again. All four independent studio engineers in the Twin Cities believe musicians will still need outside ears and feedback from human engineers and producers into the foreseeable future.
All right, so that'll get me started.
For WGLT News, I'm John Norton.
Just do one more thing.
Slice a couple ideas even together that weren't technically related. Come on
down. John Norton says there are also a number of online companies that can sync individual tracks across the web, which allows musicians to work together from different spaces. Another company has designed an interactive online platform that allows home musicians to collaborate online with world-class session musicians, singers, and engineers. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find sound ideas and interviews and stories with help today from Ryan Denham and John Norton. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet your comments. Use the hashtag SoundIdeas. This is 89.1 GLT on WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.